presentation now, and then Marcia and I will take questions subsequently. I have to time myself and wave notices at myself once if I go over time. I think Marcia has to be congratulated on having one of the largest cohorts of adults. But what I'm trying to do in this session is look at a range of other studies that have been done on adulthood as well, and looking at the overall conclusions from those studies, as well as the very detailed ones that Marcia's been involved in. And I'm looking at general findings from outcome studies, what we know about change over time, and what little we know about outcome, and a bit about impact on families, and as Marcia's already said, the needs for future. As the point I made at the beginning of the session was that most of the research on autism has been child-focused, so we know far more about genetics and diagnostic instruments, interventions, and so forth for children. The adult work, the very good quality adult work, has mainly focused on pharmacological treatments or imaging. And when you look at follow-up studies, on the whole, with a few exceptions, as we've heard, sample sizes have been pretty small, very heterogeneous cohorts, outcome measures often non-standardized, and therefore quite difficult to summarize what the findings are. So I just sort of completed a review of adult studies, and these are studies that have been conducted in the US, in Canada, Japan, the UK, and various other countries. 23 studies identified with sample sizes over 10, with a sort of a mean sample size of around 60, but big ranges for each of the studies. Mean age at follow-up 25 years, but ranging for having individuals from 16 to 60. In terms of the childhood IQ of these adult cohorts, in some studies that's not even specified. In other studies, there's individuals with very high IQ. And just looking at the range of outcomes, and many people have used the types of measures that Marcia described, although not always quite as well and systematically put together. On the whole, the average being reported as having a good outcome is around 22%, although a huge range from some cohorts, very few people having a good outcome, to others having a better. People doing middlingly well, around a third, and overall people doing pretty poorly, almost a half. And if one looks at the range of individuals living independently, the average across studies is around sort of 19%, the average living with parents around 50%, and that's, you know, in studies we're covering quite a wide age range. Living in residential care of various kinds, around a third. If one looks at people in work or educational programs, the average across studies is just under half, but the type of work is often very limited, and the range, again, very great. Not all studies have reported data on things like friendships or marriage, but rather low proportions generally across the board. So about a quarter in some studies on average reported as having friends, and in terms of marriage and long-term relationships, considerably less than that. But the data there, not very reliable, because some of the earlier studies simply didn't report on those types of factors anyway. So that review covered studies running from the very early studies of Michael Rutter in the 1960s to studies published up to 2010, on the cusp of 2011. And I thought what I would do is look at sort of changes over time and see whether the outcome of more recent studies has been more positive than the very early ones, because clearly the sorts of lives that people were living in the 1960s, the cohort study by Michael Rutter and colleagues, for example, very different to the lives being led by people in the current century. So just taking those early studies, if one looks, so I split them into ones up to the end of the 20th century. You can see around a quarter of pretty poor outcomes, around a third fair outcomes, and around a fifth being rated as having a good outcome. So small proportions having a good outcome. And one would expect, really, given the changes in recognition, early recognition and diagnosis of autism, the increasing number of childhood programs that are now established, that the outcomes for the cohort study than the present century would be considerably better. But in fact, that's not the case, as you might well expect from Marsha's presentation anyway. The proportions being rated as having a really good outcome, if anything, are slightly less. Now, that may be because the sort of definition of what a really good outcome is for people with autism has changed compared with what it was in the 1960s. But nevertheless, we don't see a huge improvement in outcomes taking overall ratings in more recent cohorts. And the, you probably can't read the bottom rung here, but it's looking at people in semi-independent living, people with parents, residential accommodation or even hospital care, people in work, people who are married or people with friendships. Very little data on that in the early studies. And if you move to the more recent ones, a pretty similar profile. What's come down is the numbers of people still living with their parents, again, as Marsha's pointed out, more people living in community-type homes, and fewer people, as you'd expect, in hospital care. But really pretty small increases in the number of people in jobs or full-time education, or the number of people with close friendships and relationships. So not a huge amount of change there. We've just finished a longer-term study, and I'll talk about this a bit more in our session this afternoon. But this is a group of individuals. We've been following up this cohort for many decades, actually. They were first seen around 6 years, followed up. We followed some of them up at around 30 years, and we've got a current follow-up when the mean age is 44 years. And we have a larger cohort that we've followed up, but these are just individuals who, when they were first seen in childhood, had a performance IQ in the normal range or the low average range, so all with a performance IQ of over 70 in childhood. Currently, as I say, the mean age of the group is 44 years, with a range of just under 30 to mid-60s. And when they were first seen, of course, for many of them, there wasn't an ADI-R or even an old ADI around, so we've had to sort of reconfirm the diagnosis using those instruments at the different stages. And we found the same sort of patterns with this cohort as well. And this is just looking at changes over the adult years, people seen in their at an average age of around 30 and now in their average age of mid-40. And you can see that the ratings for having a poor or very poor outcome, fair outcome, good or very good, very similar. So, and if anything, possibly a drop in the numbers who are reported or rated as having a very good or good outcome in the older groups. And similarly, changes in independent living and work and so forth. As Marsh has found, a decrease in the numbers living with parents and an increase in the people numbers of people living at least sort of semi-independently, although the proportion still being quite small, and actually very little change in the numbers in work. and a decrease, if anything, in the numbers reported as having close friends. And I think that some people in the younger cohorts had maintained contacts with people with whom they had been at school with, but actually by mid-40s they'd lost those contacts, they hadn't made more contacts, so if anything they're becoming more isolated in adulthood. Now, I don't want to make the picture look too awful, because clearly there are some positive aspects to in the transition to adulthood. Marsha's already pointed out the overall reduction in autism symptomatology, with the majority of studies that have used the ADI showing a decrease in scores over time, and really only a minority worsening, at least on ADI scores. Decreases in repetitive and stereotype behaviours, and at least in young adults, improvements in social reciprocity. And generally a decrease in behaviour, in severe behaviour problems, with some follow-up studies showing, this is going back to Kanner's own studies, showing marked improvements, particularly in late adolescence and early adulthood. The studies that have looked at the ADI have consistently shown a decrease in severity, although actually, if you look at the studies, the specific areas that have made most change have differed slightly. So in our study, for example, we found the biggest change was in repetitive behaviours, and that's been the finding in the Shattuck study, for example. Others have shown more improvement in communication. So the pattern's a bit different, and it probably depends on the nature of the cohort studied. But the one positive thing is that autism symptomatology does decrease, although people are still clearly falling within the autism spectrum. So some positive aspects. But there are also, and I think as Marsha's pointed out, a lot of negative aspects as well. Low rates of unemployment generally. And I think particularly the quality of adult day provision, daytime activities, much lower than when people were in school. And again, as Marsha's pointed to, the people with normal IQ actually having a much worse deal in adulthood than people with intellectual disabilities, for whom there is at least some provision around. And this is a costly group, that studies of the cost of autism across the lifetime, I mean the Gantt study of around $3.2 million, the study in the UK, £1.23 million, I think they're more or less the same. But the costs of adulthood, not in terms just of the care people need, but the loss in terms of their what they can contribute to the economy, the benefits they need and so forth, are considerable. Increases in mental health diagnoses as time goes on. Difficult to get the exact rates because they vary from study to study, but nevertheless a significant proportion developing new psychiatric problems in adulthood, and increases in the use of medication over time, and I think you show, Marsha, that once medication starts, it's difficult for people to come off, or it's rare for people to come off, they stay on medication. So just trying to look at the factors related to adult outcome, we know a couple of things. We know that childhood IQ is significantly related. So very few individuals with an IQ below 70, 75 doing really well in adulthood. And on the whole, the development of useful language in early childhood by the age of 5 to 6 years is important. Access to educational programs as well. So Michael Rutter's early studies, Kanner's early reports, made it very clear that unless children were in reasonable educational placements, the future was really pretty grim. And that's clearly changed over the years. But moving on from just general educational programs, what about the sort of impact of high quality, high intensity, early intervention programs on adult life? Well, in fact, there are no data there to show that intensive behavioural programmes, for example, that clearly help a lot of children, actually make an impact on later life. And in terms of the quality of adult provision, what impact that has, we sort of really don't know. There aren't any systematic studies. But I think it's fairly obvious that if there isn't good provision, if there's a lack of structure and predictabilities in adult life, things like routines and rituals are very likely to be problematical. And very often there are, in terms of certainly clinical cases one sees, it's a continuation of childhood behaviours that become unacceptable with age that lead to all sorts of problems. So many children, for example, very good at computing, and they get a lot of sort of encouragement to do this, and it can be a very positive thing. But not necessarily always. I mean, we have the case in the UK, for example, of this guy, Gary McKinnon, fantastic on computers when he was a little kid, got even better when he got to adulthood, and he's got a thing about aliens, and he was looking for aliens, so hacked into the Pentagon, and that hasn't gone down too well with the American government for some reason, I'm not sure why. And they're calling for his extradition at the moment. So he was a man who's, you know, done pretty well at school, very little provision as an adult, and the things he was interested in have just taken him to higher levels and got him into a huge amount of difficulty. And that can often be the case. And then, of course, there's isolation from peer groups as people lose the few friends they had at school, low self-esteem, high rates of mental health problems. So although there's no good studies looking at mediators, moderators of later development, I think it makes sense to think that all these factors do have an impact. It's clear that emotional and behavioural problems begin in childhood, and Emily Siminoff's and other studies show that very high rates of emotional problems in young children, and these carry on in adults and probably get worse because of the lack of support that people have. And some studies have estimated over 80% of adults have significant mental health problems, although the rates do vary. And many people have multiple diagnoses as well. Study involving the cohort that I've been involved in for many years. This was people seen over the years, but with a wider range of IQ, showing that about 16% developed significant new psychiatric disorders in adulthood, and another 6% developed psychiatric problems, although it was actually very difficult to put a label on them. And Michael Rutter is one of the co-authors of this paper, and in that he's been involved in diagnostic classifications for many years, and he couldn't give a clear diagnosis to these people, shows the sort of complexity of some of the psychiatric problems they show. Age of onset, about a quarter in the late teens of these new psychiatric problems, but two-thirds really in the early 20s and a smaller proportion later on. There was no association with IQ in that study. It sometimes suggests that higher functioning people may be more prone to psychiatric problems because they see the differences between themselves and their own lives and other people's. But in fact, in that study, there was no relationship with IQ, and that's been found in other studies as well. Again, Emily Siminoff's studies on children. The onset of new problems and this is not just that study, but other studies as well, showing that psychiatric mental health problems very frequently related to increased stress, lack of structure, particularly when leaving school and having nowhere else to go, basically, disturbances in home and residential life and so forth. And it may be that there's a high genetic risk for mental health problems associated with autism, as certainly the child studies seem to be indicating. And this then interacts with environmental factors to give a very high rate in adults. And I think a sort of important study here is the one by Megan Farley and her group, where the outcome there was actually, I mean, it's not fantastic, the outcome, but it's a lot better than in many other studies. So more people in her study in tertiary education, more in full-time work, half with friendships, a fifth with close relationships and so forth, and over nearly a third living independently. Her group, very similar IQ to the people we've been studying. So why was their outcome so much better? And in fact, the one particular thing about her study is it was done in Salt Lake City. Most of the people belong to the Mormon Church, which of course is known for its sort of really sort of cradle-to-grave type of support systems, a focus on the inclusion of people with difficulties as well. And it does sort of suggest that if you've got better support systems, then the outcome can be so much better. And certainly in other studies, particularly for higher ability groups, outcome and quality of life seem to be associated more with the support provision people get than actual IQ. But of course, for most adults of normal IQ, there isn't any specialist provision. They don't meet criteria for mental health services or intellectual disability services. And support networks, both for them and their parents, are far less adequate than they were when they were children. We've just finished, as I say, this study of 60 people who are now in their mid-40s, some of them 60 years of age. And one of the very apparent things, findings from this group, is that parents are a hidden army, really, of carers. Many of these people, because they're of normal IQ, haven't been in special services. And we have parents that, who actually, just going back to Marcia's point on the ADI, the ADI actually works very well even with elderly parents because they remember the significant things about autism. But those parents saying that it's clear they've been supporting their sons or daughters with autism across the decades. They're often not known to social or other services. And we've had 80-year-old mothers, 90-year-old fathers saying, what's going to happen when we're no longer around? Siblings, because we've always been looking at siblings as well, concerned about what's going to happen to their lives, how they're going to cope, knowing they're going to feel obliged to take over when their parents go, and just not knowing how they're going to cope or fit it in with their own lives. And one sister of a 50-year-old saying, for example, his mother's been put into a care home because she's got Alzheimer's, and he still goes there every day asking him what he should buy, what he should do, and just not able to recognise that his mother's no longer able to cope. So I think we've sort of, you know, highlighted various challenges in various other aspects, but I think we've got to improve the support from transition from child to adult services, and really improving knowledge, as Terry said, about developmental disorders in people working in adult mental health services, and really filling this hole that people fall into when they leave school. They don't meet criteria, many of them, for intellectual disability or adult mental health services, which means there's nothing out there. So really having much more increased recognition by all sorts of services of the needs of adults, particularly the ones who are more able, because we've got to help them, but we've also got to remove the pressures on parents as well. So I don't want to sound too gloomy. I think... one's got to be aware, care for children with autism has improved just enormously over the decades. I mean, when I first came into this field, if you've got a kid having a terrible temper tantrum, one of the things you might well do is shock, use electric shock with cattle prods. Now, we don't do that anymore. Things have improved hugely. But we do need to do the same for adults. And I think the situation now is, it's not very clear, but we're spending large amounts of dollars, pounds, euros, whatever, on the 0 to 6 years. And that's great. But, you know, 0 to 6 isn't a very big proportion of people's lives. Most people are adults much longer than they are children. And the amount spent on this age group is really sort of pathetic. And we've really got to sort of spread the money and the research around much more evenly, I think. So, you know, we've moved away mostly from people being in large mental health hospitals as they've grown into adulthood. But what we don't want is them living sort of lonely, isolated lives, or actually even living on the street. And to prevent that, we really do have to put much more money both into provision and to research. So, thank you. Okay, so we can take some questions now. If you want to give some questions to Marcia or me to begin with, but then if we run out of questions there, we can take general questions for... Can I just check the time? What time do you make it? 22. So we've got 10 minutes if people can stave off hunger for that length of time.
Yes, so I have a question about the very best outcome... adults. I know you have a few. We found some in Salt Lake City. We think it would be lovely to be able to understand a best case scenario. And maybe this is a question for both you, Patricia, and also Terry, because as I understand the methods of Terry's work, they're not likely to find those very few high-functioning people who have just gotten better and better and better in terms of economic and social life over time, because maybe they wouldn't even be in the household and they're too busy to be interviewed. What we found in the Farley study was that our absolute best cases will not go public because they do not want to face discrimination in the workplace or in the neighborhood.
Yeah. The survey was presented as a survey of health and well-being, and autism was just one of a whole range of topics covered, and the word autism didn't come up in any of the questions. We used to get very high cooperation rates in these surveys. They have declined over time. And as I said earlier on, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that the group with autism cooperate any less or more than other groups. But it's a very good question, and if we had more data, we might be able to look at that more sensitively in relation to age. Thank you.
In terms of the people who did really, really well, and we had a few in our study, and we also had a number of people who did really, really poorly. I'll talk a bit more about it this afternoon, but on the whole, our IQ levels remained pretty stable, but there was about a quarter who just went right down, and a few who went up. And we're still looking at those data to see if we can tease out what it was, either as early childhood or along the way, that have helped some people to really sort of make good progress and others to decline. Just looking at it, sort of eyeballing it at the moment, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, you know, one of the people who's done best in our group, going back to the early clinical notes, I mean, he was just a nightmare, about as autistic and as difficult as they come. And now most people could spend quite a long time with him and not have the slightest idea he'd got problems. So it is something that needs looking at. I don't know whether, Marcia, you've got any... Okay, thanks for the question.
Dr. Seltzer, you described about 20% of your follow-up sample that had disruptive behaviors, aggression against self or property, et cetera. Does that correlate with poorest outcome in terms of residential placement and employment? And also, do you have any data in terms of treatment interventions in adults, psychopharmacological interventions, behavioral, et cetera?
So in the interest of trying to get through my slides in a timely manner, I didn't describe the fact that that daily diary snapshot was only among adults with autism who were still living at home with the parents. So my sense is that the degree of that kind of behavior problems among those who have moved away from the home would be higher. We are now looking at daily diary data of those who live at home and those who do not live at home. And so I'll have a better response after that. In terms of medication, we have tracked medications over this 10-year period. We actually look at the medications and get the dosages and the frequency of taking each medication a day and divide them into psychotropic medications and non-psychotropic medication. And we see a general and persistent pattern of of increase in medication, both psychotropic and non-psychotropic medication, and a very low likelihood of coming off of medications, psychotropic medication, once they're prescribed. So in a 4.5-year period of time, we found that once an individual was prescribed a medication, he or she was 11 times more likely to remain on the medication than to come off of it. So I have to say that's a project yet to be done. We see this pattern of behavioral improvement, a pattern of increasing medication. They're obviously the same people, and I would hope that when we take that challenge on, which is, I think, a great opportunity for us to learn more about sort of psychopharmacology in the field, not in controlled studies, we'll be able to see those linkages. But we haven't done that yet, and it's on the agenda of to be done.
My question is about social contact with a friend. Does that include, would that include contact that happens exclusively over the internet with no physical proximity? Or
it didn't. We friendships with people you went out with and did things with. Some of the things that were done were slightly unusual. I mean, we had two people who described themselves as best ever friends, but what they did, they met up once a year, they got on the Circle metro line in London, and they got on at one stop, went all the way around and got to the next stop. They described each other as the best. I don't think they talked on the journey. They didn't see each other for the rest of the year. But that relationship meant something really strong. So an odd quality of friendships, but it was sort of a sort of physical contact. It wasn't just on the internet. We didn't do that. Although, you know, it does make a difference to people's lives hugely, feeling they're part of the sort of social world out there, even though it's a slightly virtual social world.
Yeah. So, from what I've seen and read, it seems like the internet for a number of autistic adults has transformed social experience, and a number of people have reported not having had significant relationships with other people mm-hmm. before, but the internet having that distance and interaction time, you don't
yeah.
have that.
Mm. Yeah, it can be very important. I mean, And some people have got such special knowledge, they're a real gift to certain groups. I got one person who was interested in a particular sort of insect. I can't remember what it was, but he was on these intersites for this really rare and I found rather boring insect. But other people out there clearly thought, you know, his knowledge was fantastic. So
one point on that, one of the privileges of a longitudinal study is you can add measures as you go along, and we're about to collect data on internet and gaming usage from the adults in our sample.
Hi.
Thank you all. It was a great set of presentations, and I would like some speculation from the panel if possible. I'm at UCSF in San Francisco, and we have a sample of adults right now that we're doing a pilot on who are 21 to 26 that we've been following since we first diagnosed them at 3 and 4 years old, and we've prospectively followed them and dividing them into those who have, interesting to hear you say, because I thought there were no data on those who had received intensive early interventions. And so we're going to be looking at those who had intensive early interventions and those who didn't, who are now adults. And in this very small basic sample, we're trying to figure out how much of the variance in the adult outcomes is seems to be coming from pretreatment characteristics before they either had or didn't have intensive early intervention, how much came from the fact that they had intensive early interventions, and how much came from a very general index of how much the quality and intensity of schooling and therapies they had in subsequent years. And you know, we have some preliminary idea of the individual cases we've been through, but does anyone on the panel want to help and speculate what we might be finding? And because I think this really bears on your question of the allocation of resources and how we should be thinking about spending money, and especially on the 0 to 6 money.
You know, I don't know. And I think it's a very, very important social question, a social policy question, and one that will be, I think that the data will have a difficult time changing social policy, even if the data would suggest that it's necessary.
Yeah.
And I think early intervention in the U.S. is mandated by law for, you know, the birth to three, birth to six social programs. And it's not mandated because it necessarily has been shown in controlled trials to lead to better outcomes across the board, although within autism there have been wonderful studies that have shown improvements during the shorter run. So I think it's extremely important that you're asking that question, but I wouldn't be that optimistic that anyone would feel confident in reducing the allocation of intervention for the youngest children. However, I must say, I think that the need for example, speech therapy services extends throughout the life course, and there is at least some speculation that speech therapy, speech and language therapy, may be more effective among older children or even adults than it is during the earliest years. So go for it, you know?
So do you think that as we look at the post-EIVI years, it sounds like you would suggest trying to break down more finely how we look at services received, like just whether they're in inclusive education, general education, which is kind of what we're doing so far in the coding, but looking at not just the DIS services,
mm-hmm.
but maybe breaking out how much you're hypothesizing that you think there's reasons to think that.
We haven't looked at what the optimal timing is of any of those services. So the more fine-grained analysis you do of service utilization and outcome, although it's descriptive and not experimental, that would point to the need for additional studies.
Well, I think the point that you all have made today, which I think is very, very important and very, in a way, very new, is the idea that post-high school services are going to have a big difference in the trajectory of development post-high school, which I don't think is generally part of how we think about allocating intervention dollars. So thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we have a sort of dirty control here in that we don't have any mandated early intervention services. So you might sort of look at your cohort in years to come and see how it compares with ours. My guess is that it's that good early intervention is going to have some impact, but unless it's continued, it's that the impact's probably going to rub out, and it's the later services that are totally lacking and I'm sure crucial.
Well, we're seeing a big interaction between pretreatment characteristics and receipt of early intervention.
Yeah.
So that, you know, the good get better thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, everyone, for attending. Thank you very much to the speakers. And I'm very grateful to INFAR for giving us this opportunity to have this symposium, because it does help to redress the balance a bit in terms of the lack of focus on adults. So thank you all for coming.